From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Matthew LeBlanc. Back in 2023, a group of scientists and activists published a warning that the Great Salt Lake might disappear in as little as 5 years. And that didn't turn out to be anything close to what happened. And the past two episodes on this program, we've been discussing why it was possible that those warnings could have been correct, but that it was also very, very unlikely. Now, you don't need to have listened to those last two episodes in order to understand this one, but it might help. And like every edition of this show, you can find that episode at upr.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Today, we're going to be talking about how the scientists and activists who wrote that 5-year warning report might have better modeled the potential futures of the Great Salt Lake. And I used that plural very intentionally, futures. Because philosophically and physically speaking, at this moment, there's not just one future. There are a range of possibilities, some more likely than others. And climate scientists use models to estimate the likelihood of each of these futures, and we always do so imperfectly. But there do appear to be some ways to improve substantially on the extrapolations that led to that 5-year warning. And that might help lead to better, clearer, and more nuanced ways of communicating risk. Joining me to talk about this today is Salt Lake Tribune and Utah Public Radio reporter Clarissa Casper. She and I have been working together for several months now on a series in the Tribune called The Seagull and the Snowpocalypse. And you can find that online now. Hey, Clarissa, welcome back.
Hey again.
And joining us once again this week is Undisciplined producer and frequent guest host Reagan Edelman. Hey, Reagan.
Hi, everyone.
In the last episode, Reagan, we asked you to flip a coin as a representation of the likelihood based on historical variation that the Great Salt Lake Basin would get an above average winter or below average winter. And it turns out that it's really hard to flip a coin and get the same result again and again and again and again and again, which is what would have needed to have happened for the Great Salt Lake to dry up.
Okay, so my question is, if the Great Salt Lake is basically this coin flip, it's just going to ebb and flow and ebb and flow, and there's going to be increased probability one way or the other, but it's by this fraction, are we going to be okay? Is everything going to be fine?
Unfortunately, this is not a happy story.
Give me some good news.
The problem is there's not good news here.
See, I kind of knew that when I asked it. But I was hoping you'd surprise me. Why is that?
Actually, to answer that question, what we really need to do is talk about how the Great Salt Lake is actually filled. Because it's not one winter. It's not one good winter that fills the Great Salt Lake. It's not two great winters that fill the Great Salt Lake. And that brings us to this guy, Paul Brooks. Clarissa, Paul Brooks.
So Paul Brooks, he's a hydrologist at the University of Utah.
The region that we have here, we have a pretty nice place to live here. We have agriculture and lakes and rivers and streams and all sorts of industry. And that's true throughout the Western U.S., but it's also true in many areas around the world. And those areas are essentially where civilization developed. So if you go to the Yellow River, the Tigris and Euphrates, the Ganges, the Brahmaputra, all of the locations where people started coming together were in these snowmelt-fed river valleys. And so that's one of the most important things.
So when you think about snowmelt and where the water goes once it snows, where do you think it goes? Like, how does it get to the Great Salt Lake?
I imagine a lot of it is runoff, no? It runs off into the Great Salt Lake. It comes from the sky into the Salt Lake. It runs down the mountains and through the streets into the Salt Lake.
Right. So Paul Brooks, he explained that that's actually not exactly what happens to the water once it snows.
We call it snowmelt runoff, as if I took my glass of water and dumped it on my desk here and it would run off the surface. But we now know from chemistry and isotopes, different tracers, that most of the water goes into the ground. It doesn't run off the surface. That has been one of the biggest changes in our understanding of the vulnerability of water resources. The majority of the water soaks into the ground. It doesn't run off the surface.
It actually goes into the ground first, most of the times before it even ever you see it in the rivers or the streams. It's actually most of the water that's in rivers and streams has already been in the ground first. And it stays there for a long time.
How long?
Okay, check this out. So you remember earlier I was telling you that I live up at the top of Big Cottonwood Canyon, right?
Yes.
Okay, let's say that I go outside and I spit on the ground. Okay, that's water, right? And assuming that that water makes it into the soil and gets below the root line of the trees, it's a straight gravitational shot to the Great Salt Lake. But depending on where that water goes, it could take 6, 7, 10, 20, 100 years to reach the Great Salt Lake.
So that would mean that even with this great snow year, the ground hogged it all up.
The ground holds on to it. And on average, in watersheds in the West, it's been estimated that the ground holds on to any given molecule of water before it reaches its eventual basin, in this case, the Great Salt Lake, in about 7 years. So if we want to know with some degree of certainty what is going to happen to the Great Salt Lake 7 years from now, one of the things that we can do is to look at groundwater.
We can trace it because there's these substances that humans have unleashed into the atmosphere over the past century that eventually make their way into the water molecules. While we were testing nuclear bombs in the 1950s and 60s, there was a lot of this isotope of hydrogen called tritium that made its way into water molecules.
So we know roughly how much tritium is produced up in the upper atmosphere and combines with water molecules into the snowpack. And by counting how much tritium is in groundwater in the stream, we can calculate how long it took that water to move through the catchment. When we go around the western U.S., or we're going around the Great Salt Lake Basin, we see that sometimes in the stream, the tritium looks 1 year old, which means it was last year's on average. Sometimes, in some catchments, it looks like it's 6 or 8 or 10. The average throughout the western U.S. from all the sites that we've looked at is 6.9 years.
And this is super important because there are no climate models for the Great Salt Lake. There's no computer simulations for that. But we actually have quite a few computer simulations for groundwater. So we can connect the rising and falling levels of the Great Salt Lake to groundwater, and we can model and project that forward and give an estimate of what's going to happen to the Great Salt Lake. And here's where we get to the really bad news. Those models suggest that the Great Salt Lake is probably going to continue to decline for the rest of this century.
But what about this additional large groundwater burst? We just had a bunch of extra groundwater. Wouldn't that add up once the 7 years hits and it all gets added into the Great Salt Lake? Does that not make any difference?
Remember that that helped this one time, but that doesn't mean that the water is forever saturated. We're going to ebb and flow. And one of the things that we know is that we are getting overall less snowfall in the mountains. And that means overall less groundwater. And that means overall less water eventually getting to the Great Salt Lake. And that is not respective of whether or not we are pulling more or less water out of the ground for municipalities and industry and farming, right? That's just the groundwater that comes from the sky, gets into the ground. And what our models suggest is that over time, due to climate warming, there is going to be diminishment. So we can use these simulations, one of these simulations called the Community Earth System Model, for instance. We can use the CESM to predict the gradual decline of water in the Great Salt Lake because it's so connected to the water that's in the surrounding basins. And when we run that model, we run it many, many times. We run it every single time a little bit different from the last time so that we have a different kind of simulation. And you guys will recognize this as a little bit of chaos, right?
Right, that flap of the seagull's wings.
Exactly. And that changes the trajectory of that one simulation. And we do it again, and we do it again, and we do it again. And we do it thousands and thousands of times. And what we get is what's called an ensemble average. And that ensemble average suggests that, you know what? At some point in the next 75 years, that record that we hit right before this report was released, that low level mark, that's not going to be the record anymore. That record is going to be broken and the lake is going to diminish even further. And then it's going to happen again and it's going to happen again. And that's just as an outcome of global warming. That's whether we take diversions out of the lake or not. The lake, as an effect of global warming, is likely to continue to diminish over time.
So we're going to have that lake level of 2022 over and over and over, that feeling that we all collectively felt as lovers of the lake and people who live around the lake.
Yes, but. Okay, here's the but.
I love a but.
Yeah, we really need one right now, right? Okay, here's the but. It's not going to happen. It's unlikely to happen in 5 years. The most probable time frame for the lake breaking these records is, you know, decades into the future. And there are only a very small number of scenarios. Remember I said, like, we run this model thousands and thousands of times. When we run this model, the CESM, when we run it thousands of times, we don't see very many simulations that wind up in a complete desiccation. That would be the lake receding to 4,170 feet. That's basically dry lake bed everywhere. There's really not that many simulations that get us there anytime between now and the end of the century. As we get closer to the end of the century, it does become more likely. But the model also does this other weird thing. And when I first saw this, I didn't really understand what was going on. It actually levels off toward the latter part of the century. So it continues to decline. And then the ensemble average levels off. It doesn't become any more likely that we're going to see a complete desiccation.
So that's something that's similar to global emissions. There's eventually this peak. It's like all of the bad comes to a peak.
And we have peaked, right? Like global emissions have peaked. This year, we will emit more greenhouse gases than we ever have in the history of mankind. But next year, we will emit a little bit less. And the year after that, we will emit a little bit less. That's pretty much the consensus opinion of scientists who study this. So that could be part of it. But another part of it could be that the Great Salt Lake is very unique because it is, and it's in the name, what?
Salt Lake. The saline?
Yeah, it's a salt lake. And do you know what happens as salt water becomes more concentrated? It becomes harder to evaporate. And the only way that the lake loses water once it gets to the lake, really the only substantial way the lake loses water because it's a closed basin lake, is evaporation. So as the lake gets saltier, there's this research from this guy, Ibrahim Mohammed, who's a hydrologist at Khalifa University in the UAE. He used to be a researcher at Utah State University. And his researcher suggests that salinity decreases as volume increases, right? So like as the lake gets smaller, the salinity gets more. And as the salinity gets more, it gets harder to evaporate. And so that may also be why we see this leveling off trend in the models.
So if we have these couple of extra decades before it gets dire, that's not the great but I was hoping for. It still is not good news. But we have a little bit more time than 5 years. And I imagine some of the measures we have to take still have to be somewhat drastic. But what can we do? Is there anything preventative? Is there anything we can do to start changing some of that probability in a positive way? Or is this just our future?
Okay, well, there's stuff that we can do locally and there's stuff that we can do globally. So let's go back to this whole thing that was like the basis of this report, this five-year report, which was like, oh my gosh, we have to start saving water now because the lake might be gone in 5 years. That's still true. Not the five-year part, perhaps, but the part about saving water, like we can make a difference by conserving. That's clear and obvious. They were not wrong at all about that. And nobody disagrees with that. No scientist that I know of disagrees with that. We can save water and in doing so, slow the trajectory for the decline of the Great Salt Lake. We can definitely do that.
But But the biggest factor is greenhouse gas emissions around the world need to be stopped and slowed.
Yeah, that's what, when we look at this long-term trajectory, greenhouse gases are not our friend, right? This is happening because the lake's long-term decline isn't happening because of diversions. The lake's long-term projected model decline is happening because of global warming.
So water usage is just one of those small factors. It's just kind of a piece of the puzzle. And the biggest piece, the centerpiece right now, is our record amount of emissions worldwide.
I would say they're both parts of the puzzle. I'm not sure like I'd quantify bigger and smaller. But yeah, absolutely, right? Like there's a huge part of this is out of our hands. Like we can do our part, right? Like you can drive an electric car and you can take the bus and you can not fly as much, and like you can do all of those things. Nothing that you do, Reagan, is going to save the Great Salt Lake.
So what I'm hearing about this situation is that the lake is in danger, and it's in very real danger, and it is a cause for concern. But this report that we're talking about might have been overstated, because it's not that 5 years, and it's not this intense, sudden, horrifying demise. It's gradual. And this likely got so much attention because 5 years and the end of the century are completely different things. They're completely different animals. If you had told me that this was an issue revolving around the end of the century, I imagine I'd care a lot less than those 5 years. Is this kind of a situation of Boy Who Cried Wolf?
Right. And I think that the report authors expressed that they were aware of this. They really wanted to drive change with this report. That's something I actually talked to Baylor Fox Kemper about. He's a professor at Brown University, and he often studies how climate scientists communicate risk.
You don't want to do something that you don't have to do, but you also don't want to fail to do something when you really should. It's a hard problem, right?
He said that it can be really hard to describe these scenarios where the actual likelihood of something is really difficult to quantify, like, right, like that chaos theory. It's really hard to say for sure if something's going to happen, but if there's a slight, even small possibility that this could happen, these scientists feel that it's their duty to let people know.
But the consequence of that is that there is a greater likelihood when they do that, that they're going to be wrong. And now you have to contend with the fact that having been perceived as being wrong, people are going to trust you less. And that's something that Spencer Cox, the governor of Utah, spoke about at a conference just a couple of months after the report was released, as what was very clear at that point was a very, very big winter was underway.
I believe that doom and gloom does not result in change. I believe it has never inspired change. And I think that is core to our human nature. When we tell people that the sky is falling, what most people do is they give up. They just think, well, there's nothing I can do about it. If the Great Salt Lake is already done, if it's already dried up and we're all gonna die from toxic dust, then I'm just going to go ahead and water my lawn.
Actually, one of the report's authors, Bonnie Baxter, was in the room when Cox was saying those things. She was just absolutely so surprised that the governor would get up there and say those things about her while she's in the room.
Yeah, he just went on and on and on about scientists. And I was like, who are the people he's talking about? Like, I don't know any of those people.
Was she reflective of that, though? Because, like, I hear those words, and on the one hand, I say, he's kind of being not a nice guy here. And on the other hand, I'm like, he's also not wrong, right? And that's something that Bonnie said, too.
In that Stegner lecture in 23, Governor Cox said, quote, when we tell people the sky is falling, people give up. And I agree with him. I think that We need to also talk about solutions, and we need to also talk about hope.
we also need to talk about hope in these conversations, because it is true. Like, I grew up in my generation being told that climate change was going to take away everything from me. And, you know, that doesn't really make somebody feel like they can do anything to create change. And Bonnie and Spencer Cox don't think that that's the right way to drive change. She says we still need to talk about hope and the things that we can do to save the lake.
Clarissa, this story started as bad news for you, right? 5 years till the Great Salt Lake disappears. And then it got to be good news. Like, that's probably not true. And then it got to be bad news again. How are you feeling right now?
I don't know. I mean, I feel like this story is more good news than bad news, honestly, just because of the context of me thinking that I was going to have to leave Utah within the next 5 years. Like, it gives me more time. So I guess I am feeling hopeful, but it's just kind of sad that there's nothing we can do.
Reagan, how are you feeling?
To be entirely honest, this is something that it's been on my radar for quite a long time, and working as a producer for Undisciplined for so long, and especially in this climate science phase, I think a lot of it has a similar story arc where so much of it is about being aware and about holding the right people accountable, but we kind of dug ourselves into a hole. And we have to be a lot better than the people before us in order to dig ourselves back out. It's a lot harder to fix the mess that we made than it was to make it.
Here's what I think. I think the climate is complicated, and that when we oversimplify the challenges, that we risk oversimplifying the solutions. And so we need to embrace the complexity of the challenges and also the diversity of the potential futures that we have before us. We're not 5 years away from a completely desiccated Great Salt Lake. We were probably never very likely to have been that close to that reality. But having more time, because this is a more complex thing, means that we can keep working on those complex solutions. And we can keep working both locally and globally. And that's the thing that I don't want anybody to lose sight of.
Yeah, well, and actually, it's been even though we had that 5-year warning and it freaked us all out, it's actually been kind of inspiring to see how many people care about this lake that, honestly, my whole life wasn't really a big deal. But it's become such a big deal over the past 5 years. And I think it's finally getting the recognition and attention that it really needed. I personally formed a personal relationship with the lake recently once I was told of its demise. Like, I wanted to get to know it before it was gone. And so I think that that's hopeful. More people caring.
Clarissa, thank you for doing this reporting with me and for all your work at Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune.
Thank you for asking me to do it.
And Reagan, this episode is going to be a nightmare to edit. Thank you so much for what you do every week on Undisciplined.
I love Undisciplined. Thank you so much, too.
Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio. And if you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us on UPR every Thursday morning at 10:30. If you miss us, then you can listen to every episode of Undisciplined wherever you get your podcasts. Our program is supported by the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University. And from listeners like you, you can support our work at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. This episode is based on a 3-part series called The Seagull and the Snowpocalypse, which was published in the Salt Lake Tribune. The Tribune is a nonprofit news organization that depends on your support too. And you can back its work at sltrib.com. Click on the donate link and use the code GSL for a special subscription discount. The Seagull and the Snowpocalypse is a project of concurrent scientific and journalistic exploration using the research-based reporting framework. The peer review study backing that reporting is called A Nuclear Bomb or Just a Joke? Groundwater Models May Help Communicate Nuanced Risks to the Great Salt Lake, and it was published in the journal Water in August of 2024.
Our producer is Reagan Edelman. Our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Tissot. And I'm Matthew LaPlante. Thanks for listening. Now go have big ideas.